that. So we often see dollar stable coins, which are crypto tokens that are intended to be worth $1 a piece. Those are assets like USDC or Trump's USD1 stable coin, which was recently launched. And the Genius Act, you know, seeks to install some amount of legislation that would regulate those types of assets. And this is something that we've seen the crypto industry pushing for quite some time, even prior to the Trump administration. But Trump's own crypto ventures, including launching his own stablecoin, have recently stalled that legislation, with a number of Senate Democrats speaking up to oppose this bill, as well as those in the House, signaling that, you know, the Trump family financial interests are a major concern for them. The crypto industry has also pushed for a number of changes to this bill that would benefit the industry. And we're now starting to see Democrats in Congress saying that this bill does not go far enough to prevent national security concerns or even terrorist financing using these stablecoins, which have been used to transfer massive amounts of funds. They are sort of the bedrock of the crypto industry, almost like the poker chips at the casino. Stablecoins are a major venue through which value is transferred in the crypto world. And so this type of legislation is extremely important to get right.
Do we have any sense of who in the United States does this investing in crypto coins? How widespread is it? Or is there a profile of typical and people who are buying the coins?
Well, there are everyday people who are involved in crypto speculation, but we also see major venture capital firms and investment firms getting involved in the crypto world as well, including a number that have a significant presence in Washington. Andreessen Horowitz, for example, is one of the largest technology venture capital firms. They have significant investments in the cryptocurrency world, and a number of Andreessen Horowitz employees have been installed in various positions at the White House. Mark Andreessen himself was involved in selecting members of the Trump administration, and they were very heavily involved in political campaigning. Then there are figures like David Sacks, who is the AI and crypto czar at the White House. He runs an investment firm that also has crypto investments, that some of which he's not divested from. So there are, you know, multiple profiles of crypto investors, many of them institutional, but also everyday people who have, you know, bought the story that cryptocurrency is a way to get ahead financially, that crypto investments can potentially provide high returns and are worth the enormous risk and volatility that crypto brings with it. And, you know, now the enormous risk of fraud and collapse throughout the crypto industry as well.
Molly White, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Software engineer, independent cryptocurrency researcher, running the Citation Needed newsletter. We'll link to your recent piece, Trump's Newest Grift, Building a Cryptocurrency Empire While Destroying Its Regulators. Coming up, the Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. He left Gaza December 2023. He came to Syracuse University. On Monday, he won a Pulitzer Prize. Stay with us.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. One day. Faith and every man.
Roger Waters performing We Shall Overcome in our studio, accompanied by Alexander Roatan on cello. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli strikes on Gaza have killed at least 11 Palestinians so far today, with deadly attacks reported in Khan Yunis and Beit Lahia in Gaza City. The attacks follow Israeli attacks that killed 54 Palestinians Monday. Health officials in Gaza say at least 57 Palestinians have already starved to death. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, reported some 66,000 children in Gaza are suffering severe malnutrition due to Israel's total blockade of food and aid now in its ninth week. Some Palestinians have resorted to eating turtle meat, grass, rotten or expired food. One displaced grandmother, Umm Hamid al-Talalka, said it took her 5 hours of standing in a line at a community kitchen in Gaza's Nusayrat district to get one meal to feed her hungry children and grandchildren.
I've been coming here since 8 a.m. to the Tikkuya soup kitchen for food to alleviate our hunger and be able to stand up. We are suffering from famine, real famine. I have not eaten anything since this morning. I cannot speak because of hunger.
On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outlined plans for the stepped-up offensive on Gaza, saying the Palestinian population, quote, will be moved for its own protection. He says the whole population must move south. Netanyahu did not say how much of Gaza Israel plans to seize. Reuters reports it could include all of Gaza's territory. We're joined now by the acclaimed Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha. On Monday, he won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his writings in The New Yorker magazine. He was praised for his, quote, essays on the physical and emotional carnage in Gaza that combine deep reporting with the intimacy of memoir to convey the Palestinian experience of more than a year and a half of war with Israel, unquote. At least 31 of Masab's family members have been killed by Israel in Gaza. His books include Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza, and Forest of Noise. First, Masab, it's terrible to say in light of what's happening in Gaza to start off by saying congratulations, but wow, you just won the Pulitzer Prize. Talk about what this means to you and the statement you put out as you learned of this huge honor.
First of all, I would like to thank you, Amy. Appreciate your work. Appreciate Democracy Now! Thank you so much for your voice. This honor has brought to me tears and joy. Joy because this is... this is a big prize. This is something that every writer, and artist and journalist, dreams of winning. But this is also very sad for me because the pieces for which I won the prize, the four pieces. I wrote about 7 or 8 pieces for the New Yorker. This prize was awarded to 4 of my pieces. The 4 pieces are one about an article that I wrote about starvation in Gaza. The other one was about the difficulty of traveling as a Palestinian. The third one was about the loss of the refugee camp. And the fourth was about the Gaza we leave behind. And unfortunately, as I'm looking at the titles of these essays, the situation in Gaza is worsening. Not day after day, but minute after minute. And people are dying. I mean, children are dying of hunger. People are dying for lack of not only food but also medicine. So this prize means a lot to me. But it also reminds me that there is a lot to work on, not only by writing but also encouraging people who have the power to take action to stop all of this.
And Mossab, I wanted to ask you, given the fact of the continuing attacks of the Israelis in Gaza and all the complete failure of the world community to be able to do anything to stop Israel, your sense of what you're seeing in terms of the American public since you've been in the United States in terms of its response to the war?
I think the American public and also people around the world are eager to learn. Unfortunately, the mainstream media is not doing enough. Israel has been preventing people from visiting Gaza, not only after October 7th, but even before, but especially after October 7th. Journalists, medics, a little number of doctors have been allowed to go to Gaza. I think the American people need to hear more and more voices. I mean, my voice is only one voice that is necessary to hear. But there are so many other voices that are there still in Gaza, journalists and writers and artists and university professors who have so many stories to tell. My story is one story. My story is other people's story. But we need to hear more and more people. And I think that the American public is truly eager, and not only eager, but I mean, they feel the necessity, they feel the duty to hear and learn about more and more stories in Gaza. And I'm happy that my four pieces that won these awards are stories that I wrote about myself, about my people in Gaza, about the refugee camp where I was born. My family members were killed, my students, my great aunt, whose body is still undeveloped until today since last October. So there are so many other stories that are to be heard, and I hope that the American magazines and newspapers and the American channels, the news channels, would open up their spaces to let these writers and people in Gaza share their stories, because this is what we should be doing. At least, I mean, killing people in Gaza is one crime, but also not giving them the space to talk about their pain and also demands, because all the time we hear, you know, politicians. Yesterday we hear President Trump saying that we want to help the people of Gaza. They have to move. We will feed them. But I mean, come on. I mean, we are not people who need to be fed. We are not hungry because we don't have food. We are hungry because we are under occupation. We are under siege. We are under genocide. This is not what people in Gaza want. It's not that they want only to eat. They want freedom. This is what they want.
Mossab Abu Toha, I want to turn to speaking at the Jewish Voice for Peace national meeting this weekend. You read If I Must Die by the great Palestinian poet killed in Rafah, Rifat al-Arir.
If I Must Die by Rifat al-Arir. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, see the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale.
If I Must Die. Mossab Abu Toha, you reference Rifat in winning the Pulitzer Prize yesterday. Talk about your relationship with him, who he was, and what he means for the people of Palestine.
Yeah, I talked a lot about Rifat. I wrote about him. Rifat was a university professor who was murdered. And this is not mentioned a lot. He was not only murdered alone. He was murdered along with two of his siblings and four nephews. Rifat died while he was holding a pen in his hand, while he was wearing his glasses, reading poetry and writing more poems to us.
asking us to continue his message, which is the tale of every people in, who are oppressed by occupation, who are under siege, who are dying in a genocide. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale. If he must die, we need to tell Rifat's tale. We need to, as I said before, if I must die, this is a crime for someone to die, to be killed by occupation. And we have to remember here that 70% of the population in Gaza are refugees. So these refugees, they have stories. It's not that they were killed by an occupation. No, they were killed as they have dreamed all their lives to return to their homeland. So Rifat died with two of his siblings and four nephews. And in the past, he lost another brother in 2014. So Rifat was not only a writer, he was not only a university professor, but he was also a mentor for so many young writers. He introduced me to the We Are Not Numbers project in 2014 after the Israeli 51-day attacks on Gaza, which claimed the lives of three close friends of mine, about whom I wrote in my poetry and in my essays. So Rifat was more than, it is a huge loss. And this is why we have to honor his memory by continuing to tell the tales. Not only, and when Rifat said, let it be a tale, it's not only Rifat's tale, because Rifat's tale, my tale, my grandparents' tale, are the tales of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And our tales are not only Palestinian tales. It is a human tale of loss after loss after loss, while the world is watching us. So we refuse to die just like that. We will fight to live, not only to live, but also to tell the stories of those who died before us, who were meant to die in blindness, to die in darkness. No, we will live, we will fight, we will continue to speak up. Because this loss, the loss of Rifat and so many hundreds of my friends and family members, should not be a waste. We should tell the stories of these people, because we don't want to lose more people. When we write a poem, it's not because we feel pain for those who we lost, but we are trying to stir people into action when they feel what we are feeling.
And Mossab, you have been telling the stories of what has been going on there through your poetry and writing. But even in the United States, it has not been easy. The right wing groups have called for deporting you, and President Trump is cracking down on non citizens critical of Israel. Talk about the problems you've had even being able to speak at many universities.
This is the tragedy of being a Palestinian or being a pro-Palestinian human rights. You are not safe living in Palestine. For example, in my case, in Gaza. I was wounded at the age of 16 in an airstrike that killed seven people. I lost three close friends of mine in 2014. I was abducted by the Israeli forces in November 2023. I lost my house, which is my family house, in October 2023. Two of my brothers-in-law were abducted by the Israeli forces, and we don't know anything about them. So, and I lost so many members of my family, as I said. And I survived, by the way, airstrikes. I mean, airstrikes that were just two houses away from me, in Jabalia camp or in Beit Lahia. So it is, to live in Gaza is very dangerous. So I didn't feel safe living in Gaza. And now when I'm traveling outside of Gaza, not only in the United States, I don't feel safe because, we are not usually welcome anywhere. It's not only in the United States, but it's most of the world. And now when we come to the United States, to raise our families and to share the stories of people who we lost, I'm not talking about another people. So this is what is different about me as Mossab. I'm not talking about other people. I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about my siblings, about my parents, about my grandparents. I'm talking about the graves of my grandparents, who I will never find because Israel destroyed cemeteries. I will not take my grandchildren and show them the kindergarten which I attended, not my university from where I graduated in Gaza. To come here and speak about these things is not even welcome. So what should I do as Palestinian? I don't know. This world doesn't make sense. In Gaza, you will get killed, wounded, or abducted. When you go out and try to speak about these things, you are being chased by these hate groups, these extremist groups. So what do they want from me? And when they talk about deportation, I mean, someone would deport someone to their homeland. But my homeland is occupied. I wish I could go back to Gaza. But before you deport me back to Gaza, I need to be in Gaza where Palestine is free. I can't go back to a country that is not only under occupation, but that is undergoing genocide. So I would love to go back to Gaza. It is not my biggest dream to live in the United States. My biggest dream is to live in my free homeland, in Palestine, to be able to visit the original home city and live in the original home city of my grandparents, Yaffa, which is also the name of my 80-year-old daughter. This is where I would like to be deported. I would like to go back and live in a free Palestine.
Masab, I want to thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us. I'm so sorry also that you had to cancel your tour all over the country. You apologized to people at all the universities where you were going to be speaking, saying how much you looked forward to sharing a forest of noise with them. I want to congratulate you on your son's birthday this weekend as you were at Jewish Voice for Peace speaking and reading your poetry. And also ask if at Syracuse University, where you are now, if they'll be holding a big celebration. You are now a Pulitzer Prize winner, as was announced yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'm looking forward to celebrate, but as you understand, it is not easy for me to celebrate anything. I mean, during the some of the events, people would be dancing on music. I mean, I do not feel fine, you know, celebrating something. The only celebration is for me is when there is an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza and also in the West Bank, and when justice and peace are served in Palestine. This is the only reason for me to celebrate. But I can't celebrate while I know that my sisters, my brothers and my parents in Gaza are starving. You know, I'm sending them this good news, telling them that this is my hope, that my voice would reach more and more people who have the power to intervene and stop this suffering. I can't just dance or eat, you know, cake or just, you know, I mean, it is not normal for me. But what is good about this is that this recognition, I hope, would prove to be a step towards greater understanding and would stir people in power to take action, to put an end. Because I don't want to continue writing essays and poems about these painful memories and these painful realities.
Masab Abu Toha, thank you so much. Palestinian poet and author. On Monday, he won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for his essays published in the New Yorker magazine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. To talk more about Gaza, we're joined now by Sandra Adler-Killen, an emergency and pediatric nurse, an international board-certified lactation consultant. She just returned from medical mission to Gaza. She was at Nasser Hospital and Al-Aqsa Hospital. It was her third humanitarian relief trip to Gaza. Thank you so much for being with us. What did you find in the midst of this total siege, total blockade? How is it affecting the children? How is it affecting the pregnant women and the mothers who've just given birth?
Yeah, so thank you, Amy, again. I'm so happy to be here with you. And I'm so grateful for the words that were just shared in the last segment. And it was my birthday yesterday, and I can't celebrate either after having been there and seeing what all my colleagues are going through, what the people of Gaza are going through. We have this horrific trifecta of starvation, of lack of medicine and supplies, and bombings that are dramatically impacting the lives of new mothers and newborns. We see an incredible increase in malnutrition levels. I was embedded at Al-Aqsa and Nasser hospitals, and seeing, walking down the halls, I was living there during the time that I was there, and seeing the gaunt faces of people, whether they were celebrating the birth of their new babies, new life, whether, you know, the family members that were there, they had nothing to share, nothing to celebrate. And yet here they were wanting to rejoice in this new life and not knowing what will happen in the future. So many children, when I was there the first time a year ago, I never, ever imagined a year later, not only after seeing the horrors that I saw a year ago and thinking, well, there's going to be a ceasefire. Things will end. Things will get better. This can't go on. The world will not let this go on. But yet this annihilation is not only continuing, but the levels that I saw with my own eyes, it's just, there are no more words to use. Unbearable, horrific, indescribable. You know, people can't obtain any kind of care because, number one, it's not safe to travel to the hospital. There's no ability for individuals to get prenatal care if it's too dangerous to travel. They have no money, no access to get there. Babies are being born in tents, first-time mothers with nobody around to help. And these babies are dying of starvation. Babies being brought into the hospital that I witnessed that were not survivable because of all of the blockades, because of the impacts of, you know, the bombings and the drone attacks and the inaccessibility. And then you have these incredible high levels of anemia, birth defects. I mean, I can go on and on. Increase in amount of premature babies that I saw. So many premature babies not surviving. No room in the neonatal intensive care in one of the largest functioning hospitals now in Gaza. So for me to have returned a year from my first visit and seeing what my colleagues, what these amazing human beings are doing there in terms of showing up every day without pay, having been displaced, having family members of their own, having been killed. And yet they show up every day and with lack of food, lack of resources, and incredible capability and compassion and strength and love. It was such an honor, such a gift for me to be able to be there. And I will return if possible.
Well, Sandra, we only have about a minute, but I wanted to ask you, Israel is not only blockading food and supplies, but also medical providers coming into the into Gaza. Could you talk about how difficult it is to get in?
Yeah, correct. So many members have been banned, international, particularly doctors, nurses, trying to support the teams there, whether dealing with mass casualties like I did the first time I was there, and my focus on infant feeding and nutrition this time. It's truly almost impossible to get a team members in. I think 30 to 40% are being denied after they've been approved by WHO. And so for us, seeing, you know, there were just a handful of us at Nasser Hospital now, we're the only compassionate witnesses because press are not allowed, media is not allowed in. We're the only international individuals that can witness the true level of what is transpiring there.
Sandra Adler-Killen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Emergency and pediatric nurse, international board certified lactation consultant, just back from Gaza. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Kevin Rabinovich. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton. You can see our interviews with Mossab Abu Toha at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CGSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.